Dr. McAleer trained in Trinity College Dublin in medicine and then in general medicine and clinical oncology in London and Belfast. He was then appointed senior lecturer in oncology and has directed the clinical oncology service. But his other interest, of course, is in medical education and in particular assessment. And he has been pivotal in leading assessment, particularly as we're now in the middle of Curriculum 25. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. McAleer as the next president, where he's going to talk about, I've put the thing down, the medical education, and going to give us an inaugural lecture. But first, I would like to introduce him as president.
Thank you very much. That's all good. Thank you very much, Mayor Vance. I do feel it's a great honour to be the President of the Society for this year, and I want to go off on that. And I really look forward to playing my full part in the role. I think they say in Ireland, we're now set up a committee, the first task committee is to organise the slit. In this case, not quite that. But my first task as President is to pass on the President-elect chain to the next President proposed for the following year. So therefore, I'm going to introduce Professor Nigel Hart, an academic general practitioner, whom most of you will know very well, who has kindly agreed to be the next president. Nigel, do you want to come down and receive your chair? It's a slightly less impressive.
Well, if no one's blue.
And it'll take you years, isn't it? Congratulations.
Move around where people can see me online. There are people online today joining us remotely on Teams, so I'll stay close to the podium for that particular reason. But I think it's a salutary lesson as to what fate can do for us, what has happened over the last couple of years. So Mary Frances very kindly took the reins for 2 years rather than one, because we lost the latter part of the first year and the first part of the second year. So thank you very much, Mary Frances, for doing that. Has given me a hopefully a more straightforward year. Those are famous last words. But anyway, I suppose the first thing to do is say the records of the four societies that have led to the formation of the Ulster Medical Society are bound into two very, very elaborate volumes. They're very interesting. They're outside on the table if people want to take a look at those. They're displayed each time when we start off the season. So also anyone online, I'm looking at you now, people, if you want to get a CPD certificate, you email the administrator and she will send you out your CPD certificate. Anyone here can collect those and probably already have. One of my sadder tasks is in this particular time is to list those members of this or fellows of the society who are no longer with us, who have sadly died since the last time this was read out. It was October 19. And I'm going to read those names. So it's John Alexander, Herbie Baird, Ian Black, Dermot Burns, Jimmy Calderwood, William Campbell, Paul Conn, Stafford Dobbin, and Peter Froggatt. Also Thelma Helen Hutchinson, Basil McNamee, Jimmy Riddle, and Dennis White. Those are all the ones that of which we are aware, and I think that's all those. So, it was great sadness that happened. We have to every time we have to read out more names, and someday all our names will be there in due course. But the next thing on the agenda, and before we go on to my talk, is to introduce we are proposing the meeting in May decided that we would have two honorary fellows of the society, which we do every year appoint one or two remarkable people, and there are two this time. The first one is online rather than here in person. That's Professor Sir Michael McBride, in recognition of his outstanding leadership as CMO in Northern Ireland during the COVID crisis and for many years before that. Michael McBride qualified from Queen's in 86. In 94, he became a HIV consultant here in the Royal, and he did that through to 06, at which time he became CMO. He also, I know, did several other jobs in the Royal while he was CMO just because he hadn't enough to do. I think that included medical director and chief executive and other such roles. But obviously, what we're recognising today is he's shown outstanding leadership in getting Northern Ireland through the COVID crisis with a reasonably clean sheet. And I think, you know, it was a very important part of that is that people have faith or trust in their leaders. And I think the CMO commanded a lot of respect on the television from both the medical staff and from the general public. I think that's quite an important role. So Michael is there listening to me, and I'm saying to you, Michael, I'm awarding you or giving you the fellowship. We have a scroll here. We will get it to you. We haven't yet got so far as teleporting these things, so it will have to be delivered to you in person. So thank you very much for doing us the honour of accepting that fellowship. Our second fellowship is to John Purvis. John Purvis is getting the honorary fellowship in recognition of his work, sterling work as the editor of the Ulster Medical Journal, and he did that from 2015 to 2020. I think that's a very big task. He did it with some style, and I think the standard of the photography and the standard of the pictures in the journal went up enormously when he was in charge. He produced some great astronomical pictures and some wildlife pictures as well. So I think he also, you know, improved the academic standing of the journal. It all around, it was a great time for the journal. The journal has done very well in terms of its standing. John Purvis graduated from Queen's in 85. And I have to say, all these people are children compared to me. Graduated from Queen's in 85, became a consultant in 95, and then had the sensible decision made to retire in 2020. And John, I'm going to ask you to come forward to receive your scroll. I think it's very important we recognise the role, because the editor of the Ulster Medical Journal involves a lot of hours of work and a lot of dedication, and it was done with true excellence and great style. So thank you very much. Now on to the other part of the evening, which is you have to listen to me for a while talking about the history of cancer and its treatment. I think it's important to say what this talk is not. If you want to know the latest treatments for cancer, don't ask me. Certainly don't ask me tonight. And it's more telling the story of the history of cancer in a few yarns that get us through the story from the earliest recognised cancers through to what's happening now, what's happening in the future. And the odd thing along the way to colour things up. For example, most people think I'm a clinical oncologist. I see myself as a cyclist who's spending a little bit of time in oncology before I get back to the cycling in the near future. I think this particular picture is quite important because you can see I'm at Roncesvalles, which I don't expect you to know, was just on the Spanish side of the Pyrenees, and I'm heading for Santiago de Compostela on the French Camino, and that's a further 800 kilometres away. And I think when I started in oncology, I felt a little bit like that. Oncology was the start of a journey. Things were rather crude, rather difficult, and I then saw things flourish as we went through the years. Now that I've read up a little bit on the history of cancer, I realise I'd missed out quite a few centuries before that. But you'll hear more of that in a moment. The other thing to say is my title slide doesn't have a listed index because I'm going to go around the clock face rather than do one thing after another, because there's a little bit of jumping back here and there in between as the mood takes me or as I forget to mention something. But the first thing is to say, what's the earliest record yet we have of a case study of a cancer patient? And it's quite difficult to find, because in the very early days, what was cancer and what wasn't was quite a challenge. People didn't clearly recognise the term. However, Atossa, 520 BC, was a Persian queen, and she developed a swelling or a mass in her breast, well described in the literature there, and had discharged, and it also spread within the breast. There was a character called Demosthenes, who was a Greek slave. He was of the royal household, but he was a slave. But he was also a healer and probably a little bit like a Rasputin character. He was up to all sorts of things. But he offered her a cure for her cancer, provided she would do repay him a grant of whatever wish he asked afterwards. And I suppose she was in a rock and a hard place, so she said, okay. He did some work which seemed to be mainly about poultices and balms and so on. But however, she did very well. She lived longer in the family afterwards. She was cured. So then what did he ask her? He asked her, quite simply, to have Darius, her husband, who was the king, invade Greece. And Darius said, well, if my wife asks me, I'll do that. Don't we all say that? And my wife, Geraldine, sitting in the audience. So I think then, whenever Darius organized the scouting party, Demosthenes asked to volunteer to be on the scouting party. He was from Greece. Once he got anywhere near Greece, he skipped across the border and he was back home safe and well. He felt a good deal. Everyone felt a good deal, and on they went. The only little snag is, you know, what was her problem? The story of it discharging and spreading, it could equally well have been an abscess or tuberculous abscess, and it may not necessarily have been a cancer. And that's what the problem with the early information about cancer is. There's no histology until you get well up the centuries. If we say, well, what about other more definite evidence? In ancient Egypt, which ran from 3000 BC up to more or less the time of Christ, in ancient Egypt, the main evidence of cancer is from mummies. Now, mummies were very, very dry and desiccated, and they also had all their soft tissue organs removed and replaced by linen. So you're dealing with bones. So bone lesions predominate because you don't get many organs left to look at. There was no tissue, so people tend to overinterpret the lytic and sclerotic lesions as cancer. Now, it's fair to say, if you look at all the mummies that are there and the amount of scanning has been done, only a few of them have evidence that could be passed off as cancer. So it wasn't very common. But given that very few mummies are over 40, it probably was to do with age rather than anything else. Now, the written record, the Smith Papyrus, identified physicians, described possible cancer in his treatment, including mostly, again, cautery and poultices. So there were some suggestions of cancer in the literature. But if I just show you a little bit what I mean about the evidence in the bones. I wonder if I can actually show you. In this lumbar spine x-ray reconstructed, there are very bright white sclerotic bony lesions. And if you asked one of my prostate colleagues, they'd definitely call that metastatic prostate cancer and give it radiotherapy. But I think it's a reasonable bet that it is metastatic prostate cancer. And that's been described in the newspaper there as the oldest case of prostate cancer in the world or in ancient Egypt. The other things that were shown were here and there were lytic lesions. This is one particular mummy, both the clavicle and the first rib. And again, if you look, there's arrows pointing at the black lytic lesions and their moth-eaten areas corresponding to it. To me, that's a bit more convincing for cancer, but there wasn't very much of it to be seen amongst all the mummies. If I come back and say, what about the causes of cancer? Well, I think we have a lot of information now that what we think causes cancer in much more detail. But if you go back to the early days, the causes were a little bit more, let's say, philosophical. Hippocrates, as most people know, was Greek, 400 BC. And he talked about the four humours. He talked about blood, phlegm, yellow bile and black bile. And he associated an excess of black bile, so-called melancholy, with cancer. And that was he was a very influential teacher. That was taken as the story right through up to about the 10th century or 11th century. So it was a very prevalent theory for many, many, for over a millennium, for 1,300 years. If you then say, what about more modern suggestions? Virchow was a very good pathologist. And in the 1840s, he saw cancer cells as being autonomous growth of immortal cells derived from normal tissue. So he made two points. There seemed to be cells growing autonomously, and also that they looked very like the organ they came from. So, you know, a breast cancer cell looked rather like a breast cell. A colon cancer looked rather like a colon cell. So he had the suggestion that they arose from the organ which they were found rather than being something that infected the area or whatever. That became widely accepted by the turn of the century, by the 1900s. I think the next big step was the discovery of DNA. And in the 1950s, Watson Crick discovered DNA. That was followed by understanding how DNA worked and how it divided and so on. I mean, when I was a medical student in 75, that's only 20 years after DNA was discovered. And we were being taught about DNA division and base pairs. That's a magical, exciting new area of medical science. Now it's taught to GCSE students with about the same enthusiasm. You know, so it's become so commonplace compared to how novel it was when I was starting out. But the idea that uncontrolled DNA duplication played a large part in cancer growth, and that was driven by base mutations. So basically, genes were mutated, the controlling mechanisms were lost, and therefore the cells proliferated, and these oncogenes took off the brakes and let the cells grow. And from that, the concept of targeting dividing cells or the cell cycle arose. The next thing I want to talk about in the causation of cancer is, why has cancer become so common? And there's the general thing that after 1900, infections began to wane as a cause of death. Typhoid disappeared. TB was on the decline. In the middle 1900s, antibiotics arrived. And cancer arose to become the second most common cause of death after heart disease. But there's also very clear, it wasn't just that there was cancer was staying at the same level. There's far more cancer than there had been before. And we know that there are many more cancers, more cancers each year. And there are a number of different possible causes like age, environment, family history, and virus. If I concentrate on the top two there, age is a very important consideration. And if I show you this graph, and this is one graph I'll spend a little bit of time on. If you look at the blue line, this blue line here, it shows for men the incidence of cancer in each 5-year period from very young to very old. And up to about the age of about 50, there's a very, very low incidence of cancer. When you're above it, it rises exponentially up into the 90s. The blip at the end is probably just artifactual. And if you then say, if the population gets older, they get dramatically more likely to get cancer. And that's why there's been a huge explosion in the numbers. And that's demonstrated by the incidence of the current population. The bars, the blue and the yellow hatched bars, are for men and women, that cancers get more common as you get older, up to the point where you start getting fewer people. There aren't many from 90 to 100, so the number goes down a little there. And then, so can we demonstrate then what happens about the average life expectancy? Probably the most shocking thing from this graph is that up until about the year 1850 or 1900, the average life expectancy, even in Europe, was only about 35. So, you know, the number of people surviving past 40 was low, past 50 was quite exceptional. I think that is the important thing to realise. There were no middle-aged or older, and I call myself elderly people, there to get cancer, and therefore cancer was quite a rare event. You can see the life expectancy has gone up exponentially, and for Europe, for us now, it's about 83 or 85. I think the most recent data from COVID and from other health problems suggest it might drop a little bit in the next 10 or 20 years, but it's been going up all the way, all along the way. If we then say, well, what about environment? I think the story of environment is a toxin arises, it gets identified, it gets dealt with, and then the cancer causes cancer cases due to that start and fall. And that's been a general trend. I'll say that a couple of examples. I take the first one. Percival Pott is only famous for one reason, because his main reason is that he identified a connection between scrotal cancers in chimney sweeps, the young boys, and the presence of soot in their skin. So the story was, they went up and down the chimneys. They got covered in soot from head to toe. The soot lodged in the crevices or the folds in the scrotum, and then that was a chronic earthing that caused cancer. And there were some horrible cancers which, by and large, killed these young boys. They were quite rare, but they were quite definitely there. And if they were salvages by horrific surgery, and I think to me the sad thing about that is that for that reason the chimney sweeps were stopped from going up the chimneys because these cancers arose. But the far more of them were actually smothered by soot falls when they're in the chimneys and never died from the cancer. But the cancer was a much more dramatic thing. Cancer was a terrible scourge. The odd boy getting smothered in the chimney didn't seem so bad. It was the cancer that influenced the public decision. And another thing that quite often influences decision is money. This is the story of the watch dial painters who, before and during the Second World War, luminous watches were very valuable in the trenches and planes and so on at night. And therefore, making luminous watches were a very big part of the watchmaking industry. And the luminous paint was radium paint, painted on by women who licked the brush with their tongue and then applied the paint. We probably all know that story. And they therefore got two types of cancer. They got local cancers in their mouth, their tongue, their oral cavity, but they also, because the radium localizes to bone like calcium, they also got a lot of bone cancers. And that graph there shows you the bone cancers going dramatically upwards as the dose to the skeleton went up from the radium. And the thing that particularly stopped that was that recognition of that and the fact that the industrial claims started to hit. The next example I'm going to give is, I'm going to just summarize. Every doctor knows that there's a doctor study done by Dahl and Bradford Hill reported in 64, which showed that for doctors who smoked, they got far more lung cancer, upper respiratory cancers, or air digestive tract cancers than those who did not, by quite a factor. And that was much, much bigger difference than for other cancers that were not. And sadly, in the initial days of smoking, doctors promoted smoking as a healthy thing. It stopped you getting TB and stuff like this, and was cool. And the smoking was very, very prevalent. And I think the big thing there was that the industry played a part. in suppressing the evidence and the information. But now that it's known, you know, smoking has dropped off dramatically. I don't think lung cancer has dropped off quite yet. For men, it's going down. For women, because they're still smoking, fair numbers are still rising. But hopefully that will turn around in the near future. The other big thing, the other big environmental factor in Belfast was asbestos. And again, asbestos is a very thin, light fibre that floats in your air, is right down to your alveoli. So it lodges very far down. It's an irritant and it causes disease with a latency of up to 40 years. Asbestos is pleural plaques, lung cancer, and mesothelioma. And I think the particular thing about asbestos is the timeline. Now, the first case started to be settled in the 1920s. The company's research knew how bad it was in the 1930s. Medical proof came in the 60s, and then the big settlements came in the 70s when they discovered the company knew about the risk and did nothing about it. And then asbestos was shut down. And the disease is still coming because of that 40-year latency, but it will disappear. Another sad thing there was that cases happened in the families of shipyard workers because they carried home the fibres in their clothes. We couldn't do it an X-ray or two. So this is just a couple of patients with asbestos-related disease. There's a patient with a very thick pleural cake or crusting rind right around the lung, and that'll immobilize that lung. It'll be very ineffective. This case here, there's much more thick, it's almost completely obliterated by mesothelial disease. And I put in this one to remind you, this is a lung cancer and a pleural plaque, that the most common cancer due to asbestos is lung cancer, not mesothelioma, because it greatly increases your chance of getting lung cancer if you're a smoker and you're with asbestos. Then, so what are the latest environmental factors? The biggest one is people like me, I'm going to say people like ourselves, but people like me who have a BMI of over 30 are classified as obese. That's a pro-inflammatory condition, it's chronic inflammation. And it's now very clearly shown that the incidence of cancer is much higher in obese people. It's about 30% higher. We already knew for a long time endometrial cancer was more prevalent in obese people. But as the bigger studies have been done, you know, esophageal or kidney, a factor of 2, breast and colon, a factor of 1.3. And those are the common cancers. And as the number of obese people in the population gets bigger, those cancers due to obesity are going to be increasing. I think it's a very important point to consider. Obesity is probably as big a threat through cancer as it is through heart disease. So obesity not only does it cause diabetes, but it also increases the number of cancers. If we now get on to talking about what are we going to do about this cancer. And the first thing is, if you've got a lump, you get it cut out, and that involves a surgeon. And surgeons started early. I mean, before anaesthetics came in, the surgery was barbaric. It was how much could the patient be held down to tolerate? Cautery was used, you know, sharp knives were used, several knives to basically collop the thing out. And not surprisingly, surgery caused a lot of morbidity and created very few cures at that stage. Most of the treatment of cancer pre-anaesthetics was done by physicians. And being physicians, they thought and they diagnosed and they purged and they bled and they poisoned to treat the black bile, which in 1533, Vesalius quite cheerfully concluded there was no black bile at all. But a lot of effort was spent, but a lot of harm was done chasing or treating black bile. Now, John Hunter from Scotland made a very important sort of philosophical thing. He described the importance of classifying the extent of cancer, not the type of it. And he recognized that the curable cancers were more likely to be the ones that were localized, and the incurable ones were more likely to be the ones that were spread distant. And that was a very important concept that hadn't had any attention paid to it. I think the next big step was in the middle 80s. Anesthesia came along, followed by soap, and Lister's asepsis together with anesthesia made cancer, you know, treatment a real possibility. And almost directly in the heels of that, Halstead came along as an American surgeon with a very keen determination to beat breast cancer. And he invented Halstead's radical mastectomy. And he kept going. First of all, he did the mastectomy. Then later he switched to including the pectoralis minor, then the pectoralis major, then the nodes in the axilla, and finally nodes in the SCF and the internal mammary artery area. So he basically took out the quarter of the patient that he could when it just left the arm in existence. But it was a very extensive surgery, very mutilating, but it did cure some people. And therefore, you know, Halstead's radical mastectomies became very common. And surgery with mastectomy, as much as people could do, became very fashionable. It was still very obvious lots of people died from cancer, but some were cured and therefore it was done. And it's worth just showing the slide to emphasize. If we look at that slide, the woman on the right with the radical mastectomy, I mean, she had the breast, the pectoralis muscle, the axillary nodes, and maybe more nodes removed, compared to nowadays where trials have got us to the point where we can do a small operation, remove the tumor with a margin, and then mostly give radiotherapy, sometimes not. So that reduction in surgery has greatly improved the reduced the morbidity and improved the cosmesis and the clinical effectiveness. Now, as radiotherapy and then chemotherapy started to flourish, clinical trials established the place of less surgery in breast cancer. And I think radiotherapy with more limited surgery was shown in several different series and trials reported by Fisher for NSABP. And they basically show that a more limited operation with radiotherapy was equivalent to more radical surgery. That was a bit slow message, a bit slow to take on, but it's very clearly established in about 15 years. So by the 90s, that was being done. And if you look at the overall curing of cancer at the moment, surgery cures more cases still. Radiotherapy comes next, then chemotherapy is chasing along, catching up very quickly. And probably the systemic therapies will overtake a radiotherapy in the very near future in terms of the number of cancers they cure. And I think that's going to continue. In fact, the role of surgery will probably diminish even more. I may tag back to that near the end. I'm going to finish off surgery by talking about hormone therapy. We know there are certain organs, such as the breast and the prostate, that respond to estrogen and testosterone respectively, progesterone respectively. So in those particular organs, whenever they become cancerous, we know they retain the hormone sensitivity. So therefore, blocking estrogens can help to shrink or cure a breast cancer. Blocking testosterone secretion can improve the outcome and improve the long-term survival of prostate cancer patients. And therefore, that hormone therapy was a very important part of the early management when chemotherapy didn't exist. Initially, it was done by surgery, in other words, oophorectomy to get rid of estrogen, and orchidectomy to get rid of the testis, to get rid of the testosterone from the testis. And George Beetson was a pioneer in this world. He reported a clinical trial, might call it a series, where he took three women with advanced breast cancer and he removed their ovaries. He cured one of them, and two of them got a very significant reduction in their tumor before it grew on again. And that is enough to bring that in as a widespread practice. It shows if a treatment is pretty effective, a very limited number of patients will do. I don't think MHRA would let you away with a three-patient trial even at the moment, no matter how good the treatment was. If I then move on to getting into the oncology side of life now and talk about radiotherapy, I hope that most people, nearly everyone in this room, I'll have taught them their oncology. Some I won't have, but the radiotherapy is about using high-energy X-rays to create anions, organic anions in the cell, which then attach themselves onto proteins. And the protein that matters is DNA. It doesn't matter much if it attaches onto an enzyme because it's million copies. But the DNA, there's two strands. If you damage that, you're causing real damage. So ionizing radiation causes anions. They cause the damage. And the source of ionizing radiation became available to us around the turn of the 1900s, so about 1895. Röntgen in Würzburg noticed an extraordinary glow around a cathode ray tube, and he clarified that was a radiation, and he called them X-rays because he didn't know quite what they were. And if we then say radiation came from that and also from radioactivity, Röntgen discovered X-rays in 1895, and he X-rayed his wife's hand, which is what I'm showing there in the slide. And in 1896, they started to use X-rays to treat cancer, in fact, to cure cancer shortly after that. Likewise, the Curies got the Nobel Prize in 1903 because they discovered radium, which gave out alpha particles and was radioactive. And within a few years, by 1906, radium was being used to treat cancer. So because they had very few effective treatments and there was very little limitation to what people could do, these sort of things happened much more quickly. The problem with radiation was nobody had any idea about how safe or how dangerous it was. There wasn't a concept about radiation protection. And this slide here is just a collation of things showing how radioactive sources were used for entertainment and treatment of the masses. So in the top left-hand corner in particular, there are radium cigarettes. Now, could you picture a more deadly combination? On the opposite corner, an equally deadly thing, a set of medical creams for the beauty of the woman. and those are caused consternation in some households as well. But that's the entertaining part of it. Sadly, the other part is this is a memorial to 159 radiation martyrs, basically physicists and radiation people who were exposed to radiation as part of their work. They often tested the strength of the beam by putting their hand in the beam and seeing how long it took the skin to turn red. It was terrible. They got lots of aplastic anemia. They got bone tumours. They got skin tumours. They got vascular loss. Marie Curie died of aplastic anemia because of radiation exposure. So there's a dreadful price paid. There were thousands of people died to get us the radiotherapy we have today. I'm just going to say then, how did radiotherapy develop? I put this in already to say X-rays were discovered, radiation was discovered, and then they started off within 20 years, they were treating and curing some tumours. But the problem was, there were two problems with these radiotherapy sources from the X-ray tubes and from radium was, there were therapeutic windows very narrow. The dose wasn't well controlled, and you could damage a person very easily compared to curing them. So a very small margin from cure to damage, and therefore a lot of harm was done. And also the beams didn't penetrate very well. They were too soft. The X-ray machines were only about 200 kV in energy, and that was much too low in energy. The next thing that happened then was higher energy machines came along. Radio cobalt is used as a source for radiation, gamma rays from that. That's about 1 MV, so that's about five times more powerful. Then Linux accelerators came in. And when I started in oncology, we had both cobalt and Linux. And Linux work in the range of 4, 6, 10, 12 MV. So, a factor of many tens higher than the original machines. And they could penetrate the beams. Beams could penetrate well straight to the patients. Then came the planning, 2D, 3D, and even 4D planning. That's where you plan based on the patient's movement with respiration. And a simple story there is when I joined Beaver, we had just got CT planning within a year or two of me being there. And you could plan one slice through the patient you were treating. And you pushed the button to plan and you went off and you came back after lunch. It took about 2 hours to plan one slice. Now at the push of a button, we get 100 slices through the patient, all planned instantaneously, faster than you can see it happening. All those acronyms at the bottom are worth saying. There are ways to make radiotherapy more sophisticated. They're about imaging and planning better. So CT, MRI, CT, PET, and fusing of those images together. We're getting MRI Linux now, and certainly we're going to have an MRI simulator soon, so you can plan your radiotherapy and monitor in much more detail. The IMRT, IGRT, and VMAT, they're just basically very sophisticated ways of planning and delivering radiotherapy. Rather than one or two beams pointing, there might be 100 or 1,000 beams all coming in to paint a very fine dose around the area you want. That has led to radiotherapy being much more effective and much safer. And radiotherapy's role now is it'll cure many cancers. There are many head and neck, cervix, and the various other things you see there. We can cure them with radiotherapy alone. Radiotherapy after surgery improves outcome, most obviously in breast and rectum, but in many other cancers. And it also combined with chemotherapy to aim to improve cure as well. I'm just going to pick one example, just SABR or stereotactic ablative body radiotherapy, to show you a little bit of imaging about. So if we look at this particular slide, this is sort of the TrueBeam Linux we have, which can both do CT scanning and beam delivery essentially at the same time or in the same position. This is a patient with a CT chest and a small peripheral lung cancer. Needle biopsy proven to be a cancer. The patient isn't fit for surgery. Oh. But a CT PET scan showed that this is a hot on CT PET scanning and nothing else was. This is a localized small lung cancer treated with stereotactic ablative radiotherapy. This is the radiotherapy dose. You see, it's very high, very localized, and then very little beyond that. So that means you can give a very high dose there without damaging the lungs or without damaging the heart. And that type of treatment is curative for many, many, many small lung cancers. In fact, my radiotherapy colleagues in lung cancer believe they're better than the surgeons treating early lung cancers. But that isn't entirely agreed as yet. But I think it'll not be long till it becomes standard of care. No bias in that, of course. Then to talk the last thing about treatment, to talk about chemotherapy or more generally systemic therapies, treatments which are given either by mouth or through the veins, to circulate through the body and kill the patient kill the tumour cells wherever they happen to be. The original chemotherapy drugs are cellular poisons, and they were targeted against the phase of the cell cycle in the dividing cell. the target rapidly dividing cells, because cancer was the most rapidly dividing cell, and if you picked your dose right, you could kill the cancer and the others would recover. But bone marrow and mucosal cells were severely affected. So neutropenia, infection, mucositis, diarrhea, those are all very common side effects. Chemo first came into use in acute leukemia, which is the most rapidly dividing cancer there was. Amanoptin was used by Farber of Dana-Farber fame in Boston in 1947. And he got incredible remissions in those young people with leukemia, but sadly they all relapsed about 3 months or 4 months later. But clearly the drug was effective. There's also some life-threatening or some fatal infections in that. Then other drugs came along. Mustine was derived from the mustard gas from World War I. And these combinations started to be successful against blood tumours, acute leukemia, lymphoma. They found combinations were better than single agents, and maintenance seemed to improve the outcome as well. But for the ordinary common or garden solid tumours, progress was very slow. Lower response rates, higher relapse rates, and toxicity was more troublesome. But they also observed that different cancers from different organs responded to different chemotherapy drugs. Now, the drug that worked for breast cancer might not work for lung cancer and so on. Chemotherapy was a bit of a doldrum around about the 60s, but then in 1970, Richard Nixon needed a distraction. He was about to pull the plug in Vietnam. He needed something to go on, so he latched on to the American Cancer Society's War on Cancer, and he brought in the Cancer Act. And there's a lot of stuff in the, you know, love story was in the movies. Susan Sontag was talking about the illness as a metaphor, about this idea that saying battling against cancer was bad because the patients were blamed as losing a battle, whereas in fact, you know, they were trying as hard as they could to fight the cancer. But that brought with it a very big boost to cancer research and clinical trials. And progress was made then very, albeit a bit slowly, in the improving the outcomes from cancer. But the only solid tumour that showed real promise in the early stage was testicular cancer in the 70s. And the chemo was being investigated as a role as an adjuvant to other cancers. Now, it is still viewed as a poison by many. And this is where I want to talk about a colleague or a senior colleague. Peter Daly retired recently. When I was in Dublin as a medical student in about 1980, he arrived back from America and he had his BTA, he'd been to America, and he was a fierce flash oncologist, and he was going around treating patients. And people, not everyone thought he was doing the right thing. But I remember he took us on the ward, and the typical ward in those days, which people remember, of consultant, two registrars, four SHOs, some medical students, a few nurses, and matron. The matron was in charge, but nobody else knew that. And we came into this single room, and we all crowded around this poor man, looking a bit green in the bed. And he was getting a chemotherapy for metastatic stomach cancer, 5-FU. And the doctor said, "How are you feeling?" And he said, "Well, I'm feeling a bit nauseous, a bit sick." He said, "Well, this is last the way it sort of is. You know, we hadn't many anti-sickness drugs in all cases in those days." And then he said, "Anything else?" "Yes, I've got a cough." "Well, sit forward till I listen to you." So he sat forward. Of course, he had a big distended stomach full of gunge. He sat forward and he vomited. And he spewed carrots and spuds over Peter's suit, from the knee all over his dark suit and his tan shoes. And matron sniffed and turned the head and said, "That'll teach you when you get on that poison." And she walked out and let him get on with it. So, just say, in the early days of chemotherapy, there were skeptics. There were some enthusiasts. So Larry Einhorn published in a massive trial, this time 50 patients with advanced testicular cancer. He gave them PVB, a three-drug combination, and he cured nearly every one of them. 75% got a complete response. Another 20% were converted to complete response by giving them by surgical removal of some residual masses. And a lot of those patients were cured. And that was almost unheard of. And I remember seeing that paper when I was in as a medical student, and really enthused me to believe, I'm very easily convinced about things, that chemotherapy and oncology was the way forward. I'll talk to you more about that later on. But to show you, whenever I started as a consultant, I took on testicular cancer. And the x-rays here, let me just point out that I'm talking about this particular x-ray here, is of an 18-year-old boy who was doing his A-levels and became short of breath, sent up to Casualty for an x-ray. And this x-ray has got multiple rounded lesions. And these are about 30 metastatic deposits with testicular cancer. Beta-HCG, the tumor marker of 100,000. Very, very high numbers. Gave him the chemotherapy, and That's 3 months later, that's the chest x-ray is clear. And he's still 15 years down the line, he's still clear of disease. In fact, he's a merchant banker in London now, trying to bring down the world financial system. On the other hand, the other side of the slide here shows my, I'll call him my friend, Larry Einhorn, the chap I talked about earlier, did the trial on testicular cancer with Lance Armstrong, who most of you probably recognize, who's a famous professional cyclist who got a very, very serious testicular cancer with lung metastases, nodal metastases, and brain metastases. He was given chemotherapy by Einhorn. He was cured, and he went on to win seven more Tour de France after he had been cured. The sad thing was, it turned out he'd been cheating with lots of drugs when he was winning a seventh, so they were all wiped out. But while he was winning those tours and I was treating cancer patients, he was a tremendous boost to my patients because they all saw him as a paragon, you know, something that they could achieve, get through this, get back to normal life, be even better than they were before. And he was a very powerful influence. He also did a lot for survivorship in cancer. So he wasn't all bad. I have a bit of a weak spot for him. Not much, but because he ruined the reputation of cyclists. Nowadays, chemotherapy has a very high cure rate in many of those rapidly growing tumours. It can be given curatively with radiotherapy and many others, and it improves the cure rate of surgery in a wide variety of tumours. And it will also have a modest impact on the whole advanced disease in most solid tumours. Still a problem with therapeutic window, because chemotherapy is basically a poison. So what are the next steps? And the next steps obviously were to consider more targeted therapies. And it's a recognition of the activation pathways in cancer cells. There were kinase cascades that are often kicked off by a mutation of DNA or the presence of cancer receptors on the cell membranes and nucleus. And hormone receptors are an example of the receptors that you can target. And the various mutations like BRCA and so on are an example of things that affect the cell growth. And EGFR receptors and lung cancer, or HER2 receptors in breast cancer. So there are a number of different receptors that can be targeted. And the key thing there is, if you could find a receptor that's present in the cancer cells and not present in normal cells, you have a really easy job then to kill the cancer cells if you can disable using those receptors. And many of these receptors are fairly good in that regard. And the first target therapy that came along is that drug, Herceptin, for the HER2 receptor. I'll talk a little bit about that. The HER2 receptor is quite simply a receptor that sits on the surface of a breast cancer cell. Only about 1 in 5 cancers have it. They do much worse. Their median survival is about half if they're HER2 positive compared to HER2 negative for the same size of tumour. But the key thing is, it's a monoclonal antibody available that disables the receptor. And that drug was shown to be fairly moderately effective in advanced disease. Didn't cure any advanced disease, but it increased the response rates and the survival. It was therefore introduced into adjuvant trials. And we did 3 trials at the one time across the world, 12,000 patients, of which about 50 came from Belfast. And I'm very grateful to all those patients who took part in the trials. They got their standard treatment, chemo, surgery, whatever. Then they'll go to years to trastuzumab where they didn't. And it was obvious to us managing these patients that the ones who got the trastuzumab were doing much better. The relapse rate was halved at 2 years. The survival rate was 9% better at 7 years in the HER2 positive patients than the Herceptin treated patients than those who didn't. And that was that's the most positive adjuvant trial ever. And we've now got a series of HER2 receptor targeting drugs. There's about 3 of them, and then combinations with chemotherapy as well. So HER2 positive breast cancer now has a better outlook than ER positive breast cancer because there's far more effective treatments for it. And I think that tells you what the possibilities are. But I just want to tell you the story about the unveiling of the HER2 story. Those trials were done. The results were worked out in the springtime, and they're presented at the American Society of Oncology, a big meeting in Chicago. Picture that. 10,000 people in a big lecture theatre. People got up at the front and they delivered the lecture one after the other. And the American doctors thought they were at a football match. They were whooping and cheering and shouting. It was the wildest excitement you ever saw. And when the lectures were over, they all rushed out, some of them with mobile phones, the sort of size of bricks, quite a few of them out to the payphones to order the drug for their patients, because it was quite such a dramatic benefit from these particular treatments. In the UK, we're slightly more measured. We have to be, because we have to wait on the MHRA, and then we have to wait on NICE before we can prescribe the drugs. So it took us about a year later to prescribe them. But an interesting point there is this drug costs $30,000 per patient for a year's treatment. Small fry now is about very big then. And we had 100 patients to treat, so that was £3 million for one drug, for one subset of one cancer. And the interesting thing there was that the total chemo budget for total budget for chemo in Northern Ireland, not too many years previously, just passed the first million. Now, of course, it's 30 or 40 million, but the dramatic impact that had on the costs of chemotherapy or the chemotherapy budget was quite remarkable. Now some of the treatments are being offered for melanoma. They're talking about $1 million patients. The treatment is going to cost $1 million per course for some of the newer treatments. And that's a big issue in cancer treatment, that you have to get value for money. To finally say, how are we going to wrap this up? How are we going to finish off cancer? Well, already underway is immunotherapy. And immunotherapy is taking the basic concept, if your immune system recognizes the cancer cells as foreign, why not get it to do the job for you? Beef it up and kill off the cancer, because your immune system very rarely kills cancer's own right. Spontaneous regression does happen, but it's very rare. And therefore, the immunotherapy is about boosting the immune system. And the problem is, if you boost the immune system, you may get autoimmune diseases. So you can get adrenal crisis, you can get pituitary crisis, you can get colitis, you can get hepatitis, lots of deadly diseases in most parts. And therefore, you know, we have to look at other ways of enhancing our response to treatment. One of the early ways of improving the response to treatment was to pray. And St. Peregrine is the patron saint, the Catholic patron saint of cancer. And his story, you can see there quite clearly, you have no problem at all seeing that on his knee there, he's got a red rough ulcer. It's a malignant melanoma on his knee with nodes in his groin. He was gone or whatever. But the interesting was that he did a lot of praying, and the thing fell off and went away, and he was apparently cured. And he claimed that was very clearly a case of the power of prayer. Now, maybe it was, but there were two other possibilities. One was he might get to one of those rare spontaneous regressions. The other thing is, I think that what happened was the nodes of his groin were due to infection in that. He knelt a lot on stone steps and ground the thing off. I think he auto-amputated the tumour off his knee. The next story is nearly funny. William Coley, a surgeon in the US, who noted very astutely that a patient with cancer got an infection, got a very high temperature for 7 or 8 days, and then recovered. And what's more, their cancer melted away. They got a spontaneous regression of their cancer. And he felt that was because the immune system was fired up by the infection. So he was way ahead of his time. And he got himself a mixture, a soup of bacteria. He half cooked it, half killed the bacteria, and then injected them IV into patients. Now, this was in the 1800s when there was no antibiotics, and it caused tremendous fever, as you might guess. And some of the patients did get tremendous regressions of their tumours, the odd cure, but some of them also got tremendous septicemia and had a very unpleasant death. And particularly when Coley's idea was passed on to other people, they weren't as good at cooking up the right mixture, the recipe to make the person feverish, and therefore there were a lot of deaths. And it was a little bit slow to eventually abandoned due to its very, very poor therapeutic ratio. But, I think it took quite a while. It worked its course. Modern immunotherapy, the first thing we did with immunotherapy was to use interferon interleukin 2, just generally give the immune system a bit of a fire on. And it caused people a lot of trouble. It gave them a vascular leak syndrome. But it did help and cure the very odd person, and certainly caused responses in some people. The more modern immunotherapy nowadays targets parts of the immune cascade, very much more specific to that part that's geared towards cancer. And modern immunotherapy is much less toxic and much more beneficial. And we're now metastatic melanoma, which would have killed virtually everyone who'd got extensive disease, and can now cure half of those with immunotherapy. And it's a remarkable difference, quite incredible. And I'll just show you an example of what immunotherapy can do. Ignore the colourful mole on the left. That's just there for entertainment. The one in the middle is a patient with a CT PET scan. Anything black is more or less cancer. The brain is grey, that doesn't count. But so if I just show you, he had a melanoma down his leg. He's got a big femoral node mass, bony disease in both femora, that's his bladder, nodal disease in both of you throughout the pelvis, bony disease in his spine, axillary nodes right, axillary nodes left, dodgy left humerus, lots of nodes in the neck. He's riddled with cancer, as they say. Now, after 4 cycles of immunotherapy, just 12 weeks later, if you look at this, this is the same patient, and you can see his bladder looks the same, and you can see there that disease is virtually all gone. Now, sadly, he wasn't a long-term remission, but he got a very dramatic response to immunotherapy, and that's the type of thing that immunotherapy can do, and is curing many of those people. A slightly more personalised story. Barbara has given me permission to talk about her story. And in 1995, Barbara came to me at age of 25, having had melanoma for about 5 years, and she'd got disease that wasn't treatable. So she had got melanoma removed from her arm, but she got recurrent disease in her axilla, resected and recurred deep up in the axilla, couldn't be resected. She got nodules in her lungs, both lungs, and she got multiple skin nodules. And we gave her interleukin-2 and interferon, that thing I talked about being a very general immunotherapy stimulus. That's what we had in 1995. She tells me she spent 50 days in hospital. I don't doubt a word of it. It was a very toxic treatment. But her disease responded completely. She's still alive and well. In fact, she's now fundraised her and her husband for the Friends of the Cancer Centre. And she's got that 10-year-old son who was born 10 or 15 years after she'd had her melanoma. So that's what immunotherapy can do. Even the crudest immunotherapy could do that, just not often enough. The problem with interleukin-2 was only about 5 to 10% were long-term remissions. And that was too big a price to pay. I'm not going to talk about modern therapies in detail, but we can target things that tumor vasculature, we can target growth paths like EGFR, we can target mutated genes, and we can identify mutations that are growth promoting. And you can get new agents to target those mutations, and therefore you're saying, I'm treating a patient with a particular ALK mutation rather than I'm treating a patient with a lung cancer or whatever. And there's a trend now to say, which mutation will this drug treat? Not which cancer will it treat. I think that's an important way forward, because cancer has been seen as a disease of the DNA. It's what's happening in your DNA, not which organ you're in, that matters in that. And I think that, you know, the full picture around the molecular future, which is where the next generation of oncologists are going to come in, we'll get their thrills, will be mutation test the patient. We can do that already. We can pick out DPD intolerance, which if you have DPD deficiency, you wind up getting very bad reactions to some chemotherapy drugs. We can assess the likelihood of benefit from treatment just in general by your gene activity in your breast cancer. We do that already for Oncotype DX. But then the much more important thing, I leave out the liquid biopsy, which is about harvesting DNA from the blood. But mutation screening of a tumour to generate a mutation map, we can do that now. In fact, we get it done. Some patients go off and get it done. They come back with £2,000 worth of printer paper. Well, it costs £2,000, but there's 50 sheets of paper with endless little base differences here and there. Nobody knows what they mean. But I think it'll not be too long till we do know what they mean. And we will need a lot more data to work out how we treat those deficiencies and so on. So I think, you know, what I'm summarizing by saying there is the future is about mutation analysis of the patient and the tumor. Get the tumor the best treatment and get the patient the least toxic treatment. I put down some numbers there to remind me to finish up on this particular note. Whenever I entered oncology, which is sadly as long ago as 1985, the 10-year survival rate for cancer was 25%. It was a very out-of-favour specialty. In fact, when I was in Alton McGelvin, as I was as a medical SHO, I had made it clear I was going to go into oncology, and one of the consultants to me said, you know, you're doing fairly well, you've got your MRCP and so on, you could go into one of the more interesting specialties. You know, whereas I saw it, this was the specialty where there were exciting things in the wings that would come in my time, and I'd see a big difference in cancer. A lot of them have come in, but probably still there's many more to come. So then the 50% is about now. In 2020, the static statistics people released the information that 10-year survival is now 50%, so it's doubled in the time when I've been an oncologist. I think it's very important to say that early diagnosis and screening is playing a big part in that. By the time you get to an oncologist, you're in second wind. You've missed the first opportunity of curing. And the 75% is about, I'm quite certain that in another 20 years' time, we will be at least 75% 10 years old, probably more like 85%. And people with cancer will be able to be, expect to be cured in most situations, unless they're multimorbid, unless they've got heart failure and liver failure or something, can't have their treatments, or unless they're very frail and elderly and can't get the treatment on the general health basis. So I think the vast majority of people with cancer, when the current people are treating oncology come to stage, I'm not thinking about when to go back to their bicycle. I think they will be looking at cancers that are very highly, or patients that are very highly curable for virtually all the cases. And then to finish up by saying, oncology has been an exciting and rewarding career for me. There's a lot more excitement to come. Look, I've got a year running the Ulster Medical Society for a start. And I think the next generation will have as much fun in oncology as I've had, and as much joy and you know, pleasure out of doing our best for people and seeing the rewards. And finally, Shakespeare said, diseases desperate grown by desperate measures are relieved. I think the measures aren't so desperate anymore, and we're relieving them better. I think that's a big progress. And I put down The Emperor of Maladies there, the cover of the book. That's a very interesting read about the history of cancer, if you wanted to read it. It's a bit more biased towards chemotherapy rather than radiotherapy, but there's fault in every book. Okay, thank you all very much. Are there any questions? No, well, okay. Any
questions?
Yes, of course, Nigel.
Curious, when along that trajectory from you've traced forth from the very earliest case or potential case of cancer, did the clinical discipline of oncology become a thing? Where are we in that?
Oncology arose as radiation oncology or radiotherapy whenever radiotherapy became a thing. So the radiologists, by and large, moved into oncology because the radiologists were using x-rays for diagnosis and then they turned them for treatment. So in Northern Ireland, a few of the radiologists in the Royal became radiation oncologists or radiotherapists, as they were known then, and started doing radiotherapy. Then when chemotherapy came along, the natural people to do it were the radiotherapists, and therefore they, because they were dealing with cancer, they took on the chemotherapy. And then as medical college or as chemotherapy, systemic therapy became more prevalent, we started to get academic medical oncologists and then clinical, and medical oncologists in the clinical setting came in after that. So it was a subtle thing. The first thing happened was radiation became a modality to attempt to cure people. There were some people doing that radiation right from the 1920s, but really it was between the wars. The first toward about 1940s when the first radiotherapists were recognised. And that's why clinical oncology sits within the Royal College of Radiologists, because the original clinical oncologists were radiologists, and therefore they sat there. It's also quite a good fit in terms of imaging being an important part of radiotherapy management.
I think we have a question online.
Okay. How would that work?
What goes out of this?
Hello.
Hi, Angela.
Seamus, how are you? Thank you very much for your talk.
Thank you.
One question. The development of messenger RNA vaccines, what impact may that have in oncology?
I think I can answer that by saying I have not got the slightest clue. I have absolutely no idea. I mean, you know, whenever I started out in oncology, people said to me, radiotherapy has run its course, it's too damaging. Chemotherapy just poisons people, but it might get better. And vaccines are the way forward. Now, but by vaccines, they really meant immunotherapy. And I think, you know, you're not stopping someone getting an infection, you're enhancing their immune system. And I have no idea whether messenger RNA vaccines will do anything in that regard or not. I don't think they will. I think they're more about tackling viruses coming in from the outside. So I don't see anybody talking about them in relation to cancer treatment.
Okay, thank you. I had the distinction of working with Dr. Daly in James's as a hematology and oncology SHO.
Well, he was mostly good fun.
Mostly. I think that's where I'd put the emphasis.
He was inclined to be a little bit nitpicking. Nobody knows where people get these ideas from, but he was often looking at the minor results rather than the major ones. Wood for trees is often a problem.
I think what annoyed him most was because I had registered to sit the first part in surgery while working as his SHO. And that did not go down particularly well because it entitled me to 2 weeks study leave.
All right. that is interesting. Well, I would have thought that a surgical SHO made more value than being an oncology SHO in those days.
No, but what I'm saying is I had already registered to sit the exam and they couldn't understand how I was entitled to 2 weeks of leave. And were most annoyed is big. That's how he regarded it at the time. So, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Daly, I remember well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
James?
Yes. Peter?
James, thanks very much. Enjoyed your talk. I would think that working in cancer is
very emotive thing. So if any person diagnosed with cancer, they think it's a death sentence very often. So can you comment on that side of things? What was it like? What is it like to work in an area like cancer?
Well, the survival rates in cancer are better than many things like heart failure and so on. It's important to say that the reality is different to the perception, but the perception rules the patient's interpretation. And I think when I went into oncology, I had a very clear idea in mind. When a patient comes in front of me, I'll ask myself the question, what can I do for them? And if I can improve their well-being, I will concentrate on that. And if I can't, I will be honest with them about that. But there are very few patients that you can't help their symptom control or help their disease. There are many you can cure. And there are many you can rescue for cure that have been appointed for by other people to die. I think that used to be a very much bigger issue than it is nowadays. Nowadays with MDMs, that's less likely to happen. But you know, but the key thing is, you've got a patient, even if we know the life expectancy is a year, if I can make them a better quality of life for that year, I regard that as a win. Far better, I can make it 2 years, good quality of life, even better still. And we can do that a lot of the time. So we have to say to people, you know, here's the reality. Here's what I can offer you, and here's what I think we might gain from that. And I think you have to give people hope, an optimistic version of reality, but reality has to be in there. An oncologist found by the GMC to have given people false hope and have treated people at the point of death in a large number of cases. That's the GMC finding from their tribunal yesterday. I think that type of oncologist does a lot of harm because they create unfulfillable expectations, unrealistic expectations. And it's far easier to tell someone good news only. But I think the very important thing is to make sure, you know, level with them. Tell them what the story is in terms of their outlook. Then say, what might they achieve? So you know, on average, you know, if I treat you, people relapse in about a year's time on average. But there are many people who get out to 2 years or 3 years. And I always say to people, I'm quite happy if you try to be one of those people. You know, give them a target to aim for. But keep the average there. Keep the idea in mind. Some will do shorter time than that. But you need to talk. You just don't simply say, "There's something I can do that'll help you," because you won't help everyone. You know, the biggest shock to me is, like, I remember it's burned into my mind. I remember talking to a woman with small volume liver metastasis, saying, "I've got a chemotherapy treatment for you. It's quite likely to shrink these down and to change your life from 6 months to 12 or 18 months." 11 days later, she was dead from neutropenic sepsis. You know, and that's the type of thing that's far harder to deal with. Because unlike a surgeon, I'm very rarely responsible for the death of my patients. You know, people are kind to us. If the patient does well, they say, "Dr. McAleer saved my life." If the patient dies, then the people say, "Well, she died of cancer." You know, so we win both ways. But whenever you do something to a patient, give them treatment, and they wind up, you know, getting a serious problem, getting a stroke or dying from a sepsis, that's a very difficult thing to do. That's the most challenging part of my job, is, you know, living with the harm I cause, knowing that I have to do it. You know, if I'm going to cure women by giving them adjuvant chemotherapy, 1 in 200 will die from their adjuvant chemotherapy. But that has to be part of the mix. That's my view on that.
Dr. Michael McBride has his hand raised. Want to mute yourself, Dr. McBride?
Hi, thank you, Seamus, for an outstanding lecture, tour de force, and it would be remiss of me not to put on record my huge appreciation for all your work over the years and for teaching me the little that I do know about oncology. I'm just building on Peter's question and just reflecting on it. I think perhaps one of the things we can all do is perhaps reflect to the next generation coming on behind us what we have learnt. And the important aspects of our clinical practice. If you were to give three messages to your younger self, or three messages that you wanted to give to the next generation of oncologists coming through, what would those be?
I think it would be to limit the amount you take on. I think burnout is a big issue in oncology. I think I feel it at times. So I think that's a very important thing. You limit the amount, limit the scope of what you do. The second thing is, make sure what you do it well. Keep up to date. Because I think, you know, people who are not entirely in control of the disease they're managing or the options for it are bad for the patients and bad for the reputation of the service. So those are two very important things. The third one would be, have a good distraction. You know, it's very important you're not tied to oncology. I mean, I have family life and I have the bicycle, and they're both very important. I'm not clear which one is more important, but but you know, I think it's so. I think the third thing is, you know, don't be totally wedded. Don't be the person who's in all the hours of the day and night. You have to have another. You have to have another life as a counterpoint to that, to the life in oncology.
I wish I'd met you earlier.
Well, I think the double or treble jobbing you did on your way through CMO was very impressive. Oh, yeah, muted. That's good. Thank you very much, Michael, for those comments.